This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Bertarelli, and you're listening to the Aviation Safety Magazine Safety Cast for January 2010. With me today are John King and Rich Stoll. By way of introduction, John is a well-known star of stage and screen, a flight instructor, and a principal in King Schools, which, as everyone knows, is a leading provider of online and computer-based training. Rich Stoll is a top-level aerobatic instructor, and if his website is up to date, I have no reason to believe that it isn't. Looks like he's survived more than 30,000 spins. He's based in Santa Paula, California, and he teaches emergency maneuvers training as well as aerobatic training. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. Our topic for today is some recent research we've done here at Aviation Safety, and cutting right to the chase, we looked at a couple of years of fatal accident data. That's 338 total fatal accidents. And frankly, I was stunned to learn that 18% of all fatal accidents are the result of stalls or spins. And the actual number is probably a little bit higher. This is a big number. It's very close to 1 in 5. So I'll ask you both, what the heck is wrong with our stall training here? What can we do about it? Why don't you take a crack at it first, John?
Well, first of all, I want to comment that you also came up with a number of 16% are loss of control, in addition to the 18% that are stall and spin related. And I don't know how you lose control of an aircraft if the stall is not involved in it or a spin is not involved in it. And then another 16% you came up with are CFIT, which is the end result of almost all accidents. But I assume by CFIT, I controlled flight into terrain, I assume that they mean that the airplane was under control at that point.
Well, it appears to be that the CFITs are basically the instrument type accidents where someone descends into the trees or climbs into the trees, or the airplane otherwise appears under control and the wreckage pattern is not a classic stall or stall spin.
Well, my general reaction to this is that there is a time and a place to put load factor in steep banks on an airplane, but it's not unaware and not near the ground. There's no reason to be flying very fast and in steep banks near the ground. I think the accident we'll discuss in a little bit reflects that, and it's just simply a case, in my view, of people not being load factor aware, not realizing when they're putting a lot of load factor on the airplane, or have become tolerant to load factor and decide that it's okay. And then you can add one last thing. Everybody would say this if you're flying an airplane. Be stabilized and configured on your approach. And don't do these kinds of maneuvers near the ground.
Rich, what's your view?
Yeah, Paul, I agree with everything that John is saying. I'll add that, of course, the fatal accident numbers that you came up with, 18% involving stall spin, have been remarkably consistent over the decades. And unfortunately, in my experience in dealing with pilots who come to me after they've gone through primary training, for example, is that their only experience with the stall happens to be in a wings level configuration, a power off stall and a power on stall, a departure stall. Very little experience with actually skidding a turn, slipping a turn, seeing the stall behavior of the airplane in those configurations at altitude, or as John said, you know, the relationship of bank angle, stall speed, and load factor, G-load. They've never done turning stalls, or very, very rarely. And unfortunately, what we see with the accidents is that a turn and or a climb are typically involved. Well, these types of scenarios, these types of configurations are not typically included in the standard run-of-the-mill stall training. I'll also mention that before we get into the accident that you've got on task force today, that a typical stall spin accident victim will be a private or commercial pilot with less than 1,000 hours. They'll be operating in day VFR good weather conditions. They'll be in or near a traffic pattern, and they'll either be turning or climbing. Most of the time, there'll be a flight instructor on board, and 90% of the time, the stall spin is initiated below traffic pattern altitude. So, you know, if someone were to just ask me off the top of my head who's most likely to have a stall spin accident, these would be the parameters that I would say, well, typically this would be involved.
What are we doing wrong in the training?
Well, in the training, of course, the big push nowadays, and John can address this as well because he's been at the forefront of discussing risk management, but also we've talked for years about scenario-based training, trying to tie the training that we're doing with our students to actual accident scenarios. And even though this is an excellent concept, unfortunately, I don't think it's implemented as widely as we would have hoped that it's been implemented. So we're still conducting our stall training, by and large, in the same old wings level configuration with the power off or the power on, and not really associating that with typical stall spin accidents, which are occurring during maneuvering flight.
Rich, you might be interested to know that Cessna, working with King Schools, just released to some 300 flight schools in the country, the Cessna Pilot Centers, a completely scenario-based training program for the sports slant private pilot. And it's, in my understanding, the first nationwide scenario-based training program designed to teach people risk management and to put learning in context from day one. They're going to do a risk management evaluation on every flight that they take, and hopefully this can become a habit that from then on in, they'll be pre-flighting the risks of the flight just as they're pre-flighting the airplane.
And that's an excellent excellent program, John. Sounds tremendous. And now if we can just get more of the flight instructor community to sign on to, you know, to address flight training as a scenario-based endeavor.
Well, if we're going to change these accident rates, the only way we're going to do it is by changing flight instructors and flight instruction. And we're going to have, that's where our education begins right there.
What would you add to the basic training syllabus or even to the practical test standards that's not there now with regard to stalls? We do some turning stalls, but it's not really emphasized.
Well, as Rich said, the key is put them in context. So that the student, we're not seeing it as a drill or an exercise. We're seeing it as a pilot awareness and a pilot skill in the context where it's likely to happen to them. And so that they understand, here is a scenario where this could happen to someone. You know, many times we look at accidents and we can't think of what in the world was going through that person's mind that they were willing to get themselves in a situation where they didn't have the capability of getting out of it. Well, I think what we have to do is help pilots understand what's going on in pilots' minds when they go wrong.
Yeah, and I agree with that 100%, and there's some very simple exercises, as John mentioned. You know, it's one thing to do the stall as an isolated maneuver, but another to then bring that into the context of this is a skidding-based final turn scenario that we're demonstrating at altitude. This is what the skidding turn looks, sounds, and feels like versus the coordinated turn. This is what the slipping turn looks, sounds, and feels like. And the aerodynamic ramifications of skidding a turn close to the ground and the physiological aspects of the pilot reacting when they're close to the ground and tying all of these things together, again, talking about the scenario-based aspect.
John, I'll throw this over to you because you've mentioned it to me before. Why not emphasize the higher level of stall understanding in the online courses that you produce?
Well, we are doing it in the new Cessna course. We haven't done it in the King Knowledge Test courses, frankly, because those courses are driven by the FAA, what they want to see in the knowledge test, and what would happen. I mean, the FAA could make a huge change in all of this by doing a better job of design of knowledge tests and practical tests. We've had great arguments with the FAA, and it's AFS 630 who writes the knowledge test, the practical test, trying to get them to bring the test up to a higher level, because whether they like it or not, they're driving the educational system for aviation in the United States, because everybody has to prepare for a knowledge test and practical test, and that's what's in the student's mind from the beginning, and. If you do more, and we are doing more than that, we're teaching risk management and so on, but every bit you do that's not required on one of the tests becomes overhead for that course, and pretty soon the student says, why are you making me do this when no one else does that?
Yeah, so it appears to be a structural institutional limitation.
It is. It would help a lot if the FAA could bring their questions to a higher level, requiring a higher level of knowledge. And it would also help a lot if they would expand what's on the practical test in some respects. I mean, you don't want the test to be a 20-hour test, and they've taken it to the extreme in other countries, the rest of the world. But I would like the FAA to do it a little more insightfully than they do.
Right. And, Paul, not only do we have the knowledge side of it, but then we have the practical or the instructional side where by and large, and this is really unfortunate, but data has shown for a couple of decades now that the flight instructor corps themselves have limited stall spin knowledge, not only from an intellectual standpoint, but also from a practical standpoint. Overwhelmingly, the majority of flight instructor applicants receive an hour or less of stall spin dynamic discussion and have done themselves four or fewer intentional spin entry and recovery. So they have, the instructors themselves are almost at their limit of knowledge, both practical and theoretical, that they're trying to pass on to the student.
And that leads us to a nice segue into the specific stall spin accident I want to talk about. This occurred February of 2008 in Lindsay, Oklahoma. It involved a Cirrus SR-22. Now, as a note to listeners, we have a video of this on AvWeb. Just check on the video button and scroll down to a video called Anatomy of a Stall Accident. Here's the setup. The SR-22 pilot was getting a flight review with his instructor. They were returning to the airport, apparently from the practice area, and they started to enter what looked like a right downwind for runway 1, but then the pilot seemed to reconsider that idea, made a sharp right turn with a steep bank that would have put him on a left base for runway 19, but according to the video and the data, angled slightly away from the runway. To shorten the story here, he used aggressive steep banks in an apparent attempt to line up for final and got into what we used to call a classic over-the-top stall. Rich, John, comments on this? Rich, why don't you go first?
Yes, and of course the right turn, as they'll see on the video, was a turn toward the runway, which reduced their distance to the extended center line, and they ended up overshooting the turn to final. And of course, in that scenario, typically what happens close to the ground, the pilots get a little bit aggressive on the controls and feel compelled to try to rush the turn back in. And in this case, there was actually a very interesting stall dynamic. There was an asymmetric stall on the left wing, which was then counteracted and became a secondary asymmetric stall on the right wing. And this is a classic case in a low-wing airplane where if you stall the top wing in the low-wing airplane, it'll tend to roll over the top into a classic stall spin departure.
Now, that struck me as also a classic case of not understanding loading the wing. They were low. They were 250 feet AGL, so they didn't have a lot of energy to give up to trade for altitude, but a slight unloading of the wing would have probably kept them out of that situation, would it not?
Yes.
Go ahead, Rich, where are you going to speak? Go ahead.
Yes, sorry there, John. Yes, of course, when pilots are close to the ground, their instinct is to not push forward. And unfortunately, pushing forward, if anybody were going to learn any one instinct that would help them avoid trouble, pushing forward, even if they're close to the ground, will oftentimes help. John, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is you have to wonder, what were they doing? They were in a 60-degree bank, in a skidding 60-degree bank turn, 3 feet above ground level, call it 200 feet above ground level, and they were still, as I understand it, they were still flaps up at this time, and just simply stalled the airplane because of the load factor and bank angle that they were under. Why were they doing this kind of maneuvering that close to the ground? What was in their minds that gave them such urgency that they were willing to die over not overshooting the runway? And so who was in charge of this airplane? Who was saying, hold it, we're not stabilized, we're not configured, what are we doing here? And what one of the rules I ask people to think about is they're trying to do something, would they do it with 100 paying passengers on board? Would you do this if you had a whole bunch of people on board the airplane? If the answer is no, well, why are you going to take that risk yourself? And with the most precious things in the world on board, your body and somebody you care about. So this just makes no sense at all. I mean, we might have had a failure in people's understanding load factor and the effects on it and how it's going to stall and how to recover, but we had a bigger failure than that. We had someone who was not flying professionally, not flying stabilized, not flying coordinated. There was just nothing to be said about this except they were horsing the airplane around at low level above the ground. What we have to understand is, what in the world did they think? I mean, did they think they could get away with this? What was the urgency in doing it? Why did they put themselves in that situation?
Well, I guess the question is, why did the instructor who should know better let it progress to that point. My view of it is that after the first steep bank, the red light should have gone on. After the second one, well, that's time to recover and try again and get the wings level.
I wonder if the instructor wasn't flying the airplane, if the instructor wasn't saying, let me show you.
You know, the most dangerous thing to be said in any airplane, watch this.
Watch this.
Right.
So, but there's something wrong with our culture when you've got a guy who is in a flight instruction situation, literally horsing the airplane around in steep, skidding turns 200 feet above the ground.
All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. That's all we have time for today. I think the discussion has been illuminating, and thanks very much for speaking with us. You can find out more about Rich Stoll's work at richstoll.com. That's STOWELL.com. And, of course, King Schools is at kingschools.com. For a full analysis of aviation safety's research, check out the article in the January 2010 issue of Aviation Safety at aviationsafetymagazine.com. You've been listening to Aviation Safety Magazine's SafetyCast for January 2010. I'm Paul Bertarelli. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. For more on aviation safety, log on to www.aviationsafetymagazine.com.